Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes, a college radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today is Wednesday, January 9th, 2013. My guest is Margaret Atwood. She's the author of the internationally best-selling novel, The Handmaid's Tale, as well as 40 other books of fiction and nonfiction, including The Blind Assassin and The Year of the Flood. Her most recent collection of stories is Moral Disorder. She's written about utopias and dystopias in Other Worlds, SF, and the Human Imagination. She was awarded the Booker Prize in 2000 for The Blind Assassin. She is also a poet, literary critic, an essayist, environmental activist, and she's here today to talk about Erase 3, the third installment in the Byliner serial. Hi, Margaret.
Hello.
Hi, great to have you on. I have been a reader of yours since I read your first published novel. I think it was The Edible Woman.
My goodness, that's a while ago.
It was in college in the late 70s, and I loved the book then, and I started rereading it again yesterday, and love it all over again. And
wasn't then, that wonderful, even though there were no pantyhose then?
No pantyhose. I mean, you know, and Surfacing, I think, was the next one. I read that. I love that. And up to where we are now with your Positron series and Erase Me, Episode 3. Could you talk a little bit about the genesis of that story and why you're publishing with Byliner? It's a whole new thing, and I love it.
It is a whole new thing, and it is a whole new thing that actually opens up a space that used to be a whole old thing and then got closed, and that would be serialization. So when Charles Dickens was writing his first books, that's how he put them out there. They were serials. And with something like Pickwick Papers, he was making it up from episode to episode, and he was responding to readers just the way that, for instance, old radio serials used to and daytime serials still do. That is, if people liked a character, he made that character bigger. And you may notice on old radio and now TV serials that if a character isn't getting a lot of response, they suddenly develop a mysterious illness. Fall off the page. So what we're opening up online is that magazine and newspaper serialization space that started in the 19th century and continued into the 20th and didn't close, I would say, until sometime in the 70s or 80s. We still can get magazine fiction, of course, most notably in the New Yorker and in literary magazines, but the old glossy markets that used to be there have not been there for a while. Mm. And what Byliner publishes is, I don't exactly like to call them magazine length because that doesn't mean the same thing anymore today. Magazine pieces have become shorter, but old-style magazine length, a good read in one session. And they do a lot of nonfiction. They were the people who launched Three Cups of Deceit. And they started to do fiction beginning with Amy Tan.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the people involved with it are from the magazine world. So they understand that kind of writing. Some of them have done it, and some of them have been editing it for a very long time. And I became acquainted with it through Amy Grace Lloyd, who has a background with the New York Review of Books and with the New Yorker and with Playboy. So she is now editing for Byliner, and she said, why don't you give it a whirl? And so we did one episode, the first episode, and that was so well received that we decided to expand it into a serial and see what the new rules for serialization might turn out to be, especially how you would sell something like that. Is it episode by episode? Do you put it into a box set? Is it like add a pearl? You know, do you keep adding an episode on? How is that going to work? And Amazon actually has a storefront for serials at the moment, but they seem to want exclusive.
Hmm, of course. So talk about the positron series.
The positron series began with the very first episode, which is called I'm Starved for You, and it is now a freebie, so it's now the introductory one, and it posits a world in the near future, a location I like, because nobody can check it out, in which you're not going to get irate letters from readers saying there is not a telephone booth there. Well, there is in the near future. So it's in the near future in the United States, which has a large separation between the people at the top and the people at the bottom due to the offshoring and roboticizing of a lot of jobs. So down at the bottom, it's pretty much mayhem because public space has been given up. And a lot of people who used to be middle managers and have quite good jobs find themselves living in their cars. Positron offers a solution to that. It offers full employment. So if you sign into the Consilience Positron model, you find yourself in a variegated community consisting of an outer rim, which is the town, and an inner core, which is the positron prison. And people in the town take turns. So one month they're prisoners, and the next month they're civilians and working in the town or acting as guards, etc., at the prison. And then the next month after that, everybody switches again on switchover day. And the other big benefit is that you timeshare your house. So couple number one, when they're in prison, couple number two is living in the house. And then you switch over, and couple number one is in the house, and couple number two is in the prison. So you might imagine there might be a few moments of irritability about how clean you left the place, whether you've cut the hedge, etc. But couple number one never meets couple number two. So we're following couple number one, consisting of Stan and Charmaine. And Stan has fallen in love with the wife of couple number two, whom he has never seen, due to a note that he found, which he thought was written by her, addressed to couple number two's husband, but rather steamy. So since Charmaine has never written him a note like that, he gets quite fixated on this person whom he has never seen and starts trying to track her down. Meanwhile, little does he know that note was actually written by his wife, Charmaine, to the husband of couple number two, with whom she's having a torrid affair on switchover day. So a torrid affair that consists of once a month, well-spaced, keeps up the interest.
Yeah, sure
so that's
does.
The setup. And then it gets more complex in episodes two and three as we discover who the wife of couple number two actually is, what her job is, and what she's up to.
Mm. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Margaret Atwood, and we're talking about the Positron series and so much else. So I'm so curious now. So you said you did the first episode, and Byliner and you were just seeing sort of what the response was, and the response was great, and so you went on to do two and three. And
yes.
So I'm guessing then there is no end of the book yet.
There is no end of the book yet. I'm doing four right now,
mm-hmm.
but I foresee possibly nine.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe not nine online. We'll see about that. I think eventually it will turn into a book.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to rearrange it a bit because one thing about a serial is you have to keep reminding people of what happened,
mm-hmm.
of what just happened. And in a book, you as a rule, remember what happened in the last chapter.
Mm-hmm. I love it, though. I love the form, and it seems that Well, TV shows do that, right? I mean, TV shows are often episodic. The ones that maybe we love, and especially some of the thrillers are very dramatic.
Yeah, or Downton Abbey or Game of Thrones.
Yeah, so why not
books?
They are
episodic, and people wait to see what's going to happen next.
Yeah, exactly. So why not books? I mean, I think it's such a fascinating genre that is coming back. I love that it's coming back.
Yes, in fact, on Pando Daily, around the turn of the year, they had a significant trend for 2013, and serialization was one of them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So the internet allows that in a way that magazines and newspapers don't anymore.
Yeah. Does reader response at all influence what happens next for you?
I think it influences the fact that something happens next. In other words, if everybody had said, we hate this, then I wouldn't have written another one.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a cheering section, but you're also not getting the input of reviewers in the same way you would for a book. And, in fact, for books, doesn't make you sound like a chicken, doesn't it? For books, the reviews come in, but they're too late.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So for this, reader response, what I'm getting a bit more is people sending me things that they think might apply,
mm-hmm.
you know, or that might be helpful, or that might just fit in. So I just got a news article about the Dutch company that's making robot prostitutes.
Yes.
And I had read an earlier one about that, which, of course, is why they're in Positron.
Mm-hmm.
But this is an update, which has quite a lot more information. So that's very helpful to me.
How much of the landscape did you have before you began? Is that something that has to be very solidly set?
Well, it is. It is the northern United States, particularly areas. Well, think of Detroit. People that used to have a flourishing job.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of jobs, and now somehow that's strangely vanished. So it's that kind of landscape. And as for the effect of for-profit prisons, you don't have to think very hard to imagine what that would be.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to have for-profit prisons, you have to have constant supply of prisoners, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I'm curious about, because you write in so many different genres, what becomes what? I mean, what becomes a story? What becomes a novel? What becomes a serial? I mean, you know, how do you take the content and sift it into context?
I think it's partly a matter of how much of it there is. So some things are obviously going to be stories because that's how much of it there is.
Mm-hmm.
It's only that long.
And you know that?
I usually know it. Sometimes I don't, but usually I know it, and I also usually know that something like, for instance, The Blind Assassin would have to be a novel. There isn't room in a story for it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You know, you mentioned The New Yorker earlier, and I read one of your stories. I think it was in the December 2011 issue. The
Stone Mattress.
Love that story.
Well, immediately, the Positron immediately attracted television serial interest, and Stone Mattress attracted film interest from a young director, producer. Who wasn't quite attuned to the idea that the Arctic isn't always covered with ice and snow, but we can work with that.
Mm-hmm. So, will you talk a little bit about that story? I just loved
Stone
it.
Mattress?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It really reawakened my interest in New Yorker stories, because for a long time I just, you know, I'd pick them up, put them down, pick them up, put them down, and then that was there. And I went, okay, here we are.
There's a wonderful piece by Jennifer Egan in their sci-fi issue called Black Box, which she originally wrote as a Twitter novel.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Anyway, it's very good. So I mentioned that. And how did I come to write Stone Mattress? Well, I was actually on a boat in the Arctic, and I wrote it to amuse my fellow prisoners, and also because we did, passengers, whoops. Once you're on, you can't get off. And also because we were having a conversation about if you were going to murder somebody on this boat, how would you do it? And my partner does have a devious criminal mind, so he had some pretty good ideas about how you would have to go about it. And I was helped by the fact that there were a number of people on the boat called Bob. So it does help if you have a lot of people called Bob, because one Bob can easily get mixed up with another one. So I was I actually started reading it out loud to those people, who then said, "We want to hear the rest." And so therefore I went on and finished it, and lo and behold, there it was in the New Yorker, so we could send out an email saying, "Here's the rest."
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You are so very prolific, and I am guessing, I'm going to assume that you're not so much a perfectionist as you are a completionist, because it seems that so many writers just, we get caught up in either the, you know, making sure the idea is perfect before we begin, or we get midway in a story or book and decide, you know, we really need it to go the right way, and what is that right way? Is that true? I mean, do you just go with it and see what you have after a draft?
Yeah, I go with it, although I have a, let us call it a rolling barrage. That is, once I've got about three or four chapters, I start nitpicking them, and while continuing to write at the other end. So it's more like that. But I have abandoned a couple of novels because they were not working out.
Have you ever been rejected?
Oh, many, many times. Yeah. I spent the whole first part of my writing life being rejected. But at that point, it was mostly poems and stories. I shouldn't say it was all rejection then, because otherwise I would have been probably too discouraged. But sure. We all have our share of rejection notices.
Speaking of poetry, I was also aware of you as a poet early on, and I'm curious about the crossover of poetry into your other writing.
I don't know what I can say about that, except that it's a very different thing. So I think it involves two different parts of the brain, and you could say that sometimes poems open doors into narratives or areas or landscapes, but that's a big generalization. I think the wavelengths of a poem are a lot shorter. By wavelengths, I mean repeating patterns. And with a poem, they're very close together. And with a novel, they're very far apart. And with a story, they're somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I took a look at your website this morning very quickly and saw something on there about coffee.
Yes.
Will you talk about
that? That has to do with the bird activities. A company called Balzac's, which is a fair trade, eco-friendly coffee company, came and said if they could name a coffee after me and use my likeness, they would donate $1 a bag to the Pelee Island Bird Observatory, which is something that we are involved with. So this is not something that is a source of income for myself. But it does create awareness of this bird observatory, and also it contributes to it. And did we test out the coffee? Yes, we did. we sent it back, and us for a somewhat different combo. And now it's pretty good. We use it all the time.
Hmm. And if you out there want to know what we're talking about, just go to Margaret's website. I think it's margaretatwood.ca for Canada. In there, getting back to your early work, in the back of the copy of The Edible Woman that I have, there's an interview with you. And I think it was done, done in the 70s maybe?
A
while ago. And you talk about writing, and I think the interviewer is asking you about, do you enjoy writing, on. And you talk a bit about the physical aspect of writing that bothers you.
Oh, you mean do back exercises?
Yeah, or editing.
Editing, yeah. Well, editing is not physical entirely, but, well, it's not. Actually, it's your mind revisioning things. I think by the physical, I would probably just say do the back exercises, because that's what's going to give out.
Mm-hmm.
That and the people get carpal tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And for carpal tunnel, what you need is an extended keyboard. And for the back exercises, you need a good chair and a Pilates teacher.
Yeah, or, a stand-up desk, something.
A stand-up desk, yeah. Hemingway had one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And that, if you have one of those that you can switch off on, it can be good.
Yeah, and
are you having that problem?
I think I'm having some hand problems, but I think they're more due to knitting than anything else.
Oh, knitting,
else.
Yes.
Purling the wrong way, I don't know, something, but anyway. What about revision, though? Do you like it? Do you find the work comes alive then? Do you do it because you must? I mean, how many drafts might you put something through, or have you put, say, your episodes
six
through?
Six minimum.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just the way it is. And revision is what it says. It's revision. So you're seeing it with new eyes, we hope. And it's always good to leave a space between when you finish and when you start revising, because then you can read it through in the nearest approximation to being a reader of it that you will ever get. You'll never really be a reader of it, because guess what? You know what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So you can never have a really fresh read, but you can get something that approximates that.
Mm-hmm. You know, the upside of the internet and publishing are places like Byliner.com, where you can do serials and get work on there quick and get reader response and all that. And the downside I found is that writers can be a little too impatient in terms of getting their work out there. They want to get published right away. They want to get it out there.
So you're thinking of maybe self-published books?
Self-published books, or even just when you start writing and you have a story, and where can I get this published? Before you let it sit, before you revise enough, before you let it chill to the point where you can see it again and you can polish it and work on it. You know, what can you say about patience in terms of writing?
Well, either you have it or you don't. And with some people, it doesn't seem to matter. And with other people, it would really be indicated. But that is usually what you have an agent and some publishers, readers for, is it not? But if you don't have those people, what are you going to do? Well, sometimes belonging to a writer's group might help with that. Don't give it to your spouse. It's really a bad idea, because either they have to say they love it, and if they really do love it, that's good, or they are going to say something critical, which will cause things to be pretty frosty for a while.
Mm-hmm. Back to Positron. What do you hope people, readers, are left with in reading this or reading other of your works that are about dystopias or utopias? What do you hope to affect?
Don't go there. Among other things. But it's that whole debate, which has been going on for at least 3,000 years, should a work be entertaining, or should it be instructive, or should it be both?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's only entertaining, it's a beach read. You read it once, it's gone. If it's only instructive, you probably are not going to get past page 20. Or it's a textbook.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what artists of all kinds have always tried to do. And if you make a song analogy, it becomes very clear. So the song may be about something very worthy, but it's a horrible song.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So nobody listens to it.
Right.
Or it can be a very catchy tune that doesn't really have anything other than that, in which case it's bubblegum music.
That reminds me of another discussion you had with this interviewer in the back of the Edible Woman about, I think he asked, does a writer have any responsibility to society? And you started in your response by saying, does society have any responsibility to the writer?
Yeah, right. There's that. Well, for the writer and society, I have a whole chapter on it in my book called Negotiating with the Dead. There will never be any shortage of people who are quite willing to tell you what your responsibility to society is. It's usually something that they're interested in. So there are always going to be those people, but there's no particular reason why a writer or artist of any kind should have more responsibility to society than the ordinary citizens who live in it have. Because when you come down to it, in a democracy, it's one vote, one person.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that does happen is that people get pushed into the position of being spokespersons because they're self-employed. So they have the luxury of saying those things, whereas people with jobs might find that their job is affected by it.
Hmm. Yeah, and that sort of branches into, you know, if you consider yourself a spiritual person or a religious person and you're a writer, what sort of material should you be writing? Is it okay to write dark works? Is it okay to do that? Is that doing service, you know?
Well, that is something that individual writers will have to decide for themselves. It's not something that I can really have any opinion on, because there's one thing that you should never do, which is try to tell artists what they should do.
Yeah.
Number one, they'll do the opposite immediately, but also people who do control artists in that way are usually in totalitarian societies.
It's interesting. We have been here with Margaret Atwood, and one last question. I guess I'd love to know, are there other things that sustain your writing? Is there any advice that you've received along the way that stuck with you and has been helpful, in particular when perhaps you're in a place where your writing isn't working and you need to write yourself out of it or get out of it in some way and move on? Any tips for...
Quote from my mother, go for a walk. Yeah, I used to think she was wildly old-fashioned about that, but it apparently said the brain people, she was right.
Mm-hmm.
So any form of repetitive action, like ironing, I kind of like ironing myself, that isn't focused on the writing can be very helpful, and so can simply going to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So go to sleep with the problem. Keep the notebook by the bed. When you wake up, you will sometimes, not always, but often, have the solution to the problem that you posed to your unconscious.
Mm. Thank you, and thank you so much for taking the time here. It's been lovely.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It was Margaret Atwood, and her current work is the Positron series. You can find it on Byliner. And her website is invaluable as well. When we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about Byliner and a few other things. So stay with us, and Be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. We gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
I lost my mojo.
You lost it?
Lost it.
Where'd it go?
I don't know, but I found it. I found it on Writers on Writing.
Writers on Writing?
Wednesday mornings at 9. 9 a.m. in the morning.
With Barbara DeMarco Barrett and Marie Stone?
That's them.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting on iTunes, College Radio, and KUCI.org. And I've been getting some messages, some posts, and various things from listeners of the last 40 minutes with Margaret Atwood. And if you tuned in late or you didn't get to hear the interview, and you're here now, well, you are a little bit late, just a little bit. But I hope to podcast this show in the next few days. So visit penonfire.com, and there are other podcasts there. I just put up the one from last week on self-published authors talking about self-publishing and what's working for them and what they hope to accomplish and tips and all sorts of things. So check out penonfire.com. You can find archived podcasts, meaning any show that has run on Writers on Writing should be there. And if it's not, send me an email and tell me so I can fix the link on writersonwriting.blogspot.com. Anyway, we did spend the last 40 minutes with Margaret Atwood, one of my favorite authors. And I think I started talking about The Edible Woman, her first novel. Back in, let me look here at the publication date. I think it came out in 70 or 71. 1970, originally published by Little Brown. And I remember reading this book and just loving it. And now looking back at it, I can see the seeds of Atwood's sort of current thrust in fiction with dystopian literature, because The Edible Woman has a protagonist, Marion McAlpin, who can't eat, and she feels that she's being eaten. And it's just, it's so interesting. It's a wonderful book. And then Surfacing, which came out after, and this, I think, as I recall, I need to read this one again, but I think it was really about a woman having a nervous breakdown, and things are going awry in her life, in her world, and so interesting to watch the process of writers who've been at it for a long time and how their writing changes and evolves and goes into new directions, which often contain the seeds of their original works. So there are books of Atwood's that I have missed that I will read. I never read The Blind Assassin, and I feel that I've missed out on something, so I'm going to be sure to read that. And we spent some time talking about her serialized novel, The Positron series in Byliner. And Byliner is a site you might want to check out. It's really interesting. Some great stuff on there. It's byliner.com. And there are freebies, and then you can also subscribe to, I don't know, it's like a monthly fee, maybe $7.99 to have full access to anything on there. And there is great stuff going on Byliner. Just wonderful stories and nonfiction pieces I want to get back to. And I love that serialized fiction is starting up again. And a way to support that and to ensure your own writing success, writing life, outlets for your writing is to spend time on sites like Byliner. And sort of like what we always say with literary journals, if you want to be published in them, then you need to buy them to keep them alive. Or you want to keep poetry alive or books or whatever. We have to purchase these things. I mean, libraries are great and wonderful, and without them, I would be very unhappy, especially without my local library. That I can walk to, and I can check out ebooks online and listen to MP3s through my through the online outlet of the Newport Beach Library. But we still need to buy books, don't we? One way and another place to find out about publishing and books and what's going on is a site that I tell my students about all the time, or my talk about with my writer friends, and that's newpages.com. I'm looking at their website homepage right now, and what I see are sections, magazines, writers' resources, books, booksellers, guides, and features, and places to place your stuff. So if I am on the homepage and I go to Writers Resources, I look down at a sub-list of calls for submissions, writing contests, creative writing programs, writing conferences, blogs of poets and writers, all good stuff. So, you know, we talked a little bit, Margaret and I talked a little bit about you know, needing a little patience before you publish, and you do, you really do. You don't want your stuff to get out there too soon. I think anybody who has published a novel too soon and has received horrible reviews would say that it would have been better not to publish it at all. And I'm grateful that a couple of my novels are still on the shelf, buried, and we'll never see the light of day. We'll never be self-published. We'll never be out there. They taught me what it meant or what it means to write a novel, what it means to write a book. I'm grateful for doing them, but I don't want them out there. And so, you know, a few years went into those books or more, and I don't feel that it's a waste of time. So when you write a story or you write an essay and you want it out there right away, let it sit for a while longer. A while, you know, let it sit, look at it again, give it to a critique group or a reader, or if you don't have anyone like that, hire an editor, a book doctor, somebody who can give you really frank advice about what's working with it and what isn't working, and work on it some more and put it through many drafts before you send it out. Because one thing that happens, apart from bad reviews or burning a bridge with an editor who, you know, just thinks your stuff stinks and never wants to hear from you again, which who knows if that happens. It must happen. But is that you, I don't know, you have time to refine and make it as wonderful as it can be before you send it out. And, you know, you can send work out too early and get rejected and then feel dejected because your work isn't selling, and feel that it's personal, feel you're a horrible writer, and it can derail you if you're not careful. So that if you wait until your stuff has been crafted and is better, and you know, wait until it's time, then when you're rejected, most likely what will start happening is editors will start giving you a little bit of feedback and will encourage you to send them something else. And it's a whole different place to be at than when you send stuff out too early, you get nothing back, and you just feel this reflects on you as a writer, you're a horrible writer. So just be a little patient, just a little bit, you know? I mean, the internet makes it so that we can do so much instantaneously. So as we were saying, that's wonderful for you know, obvious reasons, and it's also not a good thing. For obvious reasons, our work gets out there too soon. If you feel you need to publish quickly, start a blog. A blog is a great way to exercise your writing chops, to get your craft going, to get in touch with the writing and reading community. Spend time on Goodreads.com for writing community. And also, a lot of book tours are beginning there now. My agent, Sally Van Heitsma, said that that is the go-to place for publishers. They love Goodreads, and you'll see a lot of writers doing Q&As when their book comes out on Goodreads. You know, very major writers, too. You know, so spend time on Goodreads, start a page, have a page, participate. We all like to lurk for a bit, but lurking doesn't build your community for you, whether you're lurking on Facebook or Twitter or Goodreads or wherever it might be. So, you know, start your blog. Don't have to tell anybody about it until you feel that it's worthy. Start a blog and just, you know, get your writing community going. Go to writers' events. There's a lot happening if you're in Southern California, a lot starting up. We have the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books in April. It's on, I think, the third weekend in April. I don't know. You can Google the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books and find out the exact dates. We have Literary Orange that's here at UCI in April. April? May? I don't know. I think it's the beginning of April because I'm going to be there, so I better know, huh? There's all kinds of events going on. We have the Pen on Fire Writer Series that I put on. Next week we have an evening with publishing honchos. Almost sold out, but you can find out more about that at penonfire.com. We have so many things. And then, of course, nationwide, so many events that start up in the spring mostly and extend into the fall. There's the American Society of Journalists and Writers and Authors. Sorry, ASJA.org. Our annual writers' conference is the last weekend in April in New York. I go to it most years, and great panels, very affordable, a lot of fun, right in Midtown, New York at the Roosevelt. You can find out about that at asja.org. If you're starting out or you've been away from writing and need to get back, writing conferences are a great way to jump back in, get your feet wet, meet writers, meet editors, meet agents, start relationships. Writing is very much like other businesses in that so much happens through networking and through the relationships that you form with other writers, as opposed to just seeking out other writers when you need them. That's not the time. It's really not the time, because it's better to do things for other writers, to associate with them, to build friendships, and help each other. And that's how we all think get along in the writing world. Anyway, so check out New Pages, check out Goodreads, go to Margaret Atwood's website, check out penonfire.com, go to writersonwriting.blogspot.com, listen to some free podcasts, get motivated, write every day, and come back here next week. We'll be back next week with Betsy Lerner, who is a literary agent who has the blog The Forest for the Trees. She'll be here for the hour talking about publishing, what's going on, and what she's looking for. We'll have Jess Walter back in February with his collection of short stories, and a lot else being planned. So I thank you so much for being with us for this hour. And for being a listener, any questions or comments, please email me. You can do so through penonfire.com. Again, keep your behind in the chair and have a great week writing.